Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with Dirk Brosse, the newly appointed music director of the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia. Susan Lewis visits Friend or Foe, an exhibition at the Rosenbach Museum and Library in Philadelphia, exploring the value of copies and forgeries. And David Patrick Stearns speaks with Montgomery Ville-born composer Julia Wolf. She's just released an outlandish new album and has a major work premiering this evening at Carnegie Hall. That's all I have this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
The Belgian composer and conductor Dirk Brosse begins his tenure as music director of the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia for the 2010-2011 season. He replaces Ignaz Solzhenitsyn, who becomes conductor laureate and will lead one program per season. Among Dirk Brosse's more than 200 compositions are symphonies and concertos, as well as music for film and theatre. And though this is his first orchestra music directorship, he has guest-conducted many significant ensembles, including the London Philharmonic, the London Symphony Orchestra, the Rotterdam Philharmonic, and the National Orchestras of Venezuela, Colombia, and Ecuador. Brosse has also conducted the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia on three occasions, in 2007 for a recording of a Tchaikovsky score for an animated Tom and Jerry video, last year for a chamber version of Mahler's Das Lied von der Erde, and just last month in a Scandinavian program. I met with Dirk Brosse earlier this week, following a news conference announcing his appointment, and first asked him what factors had convinced him to take the job in Philadelphia.
Well, I liked the States very much when I was in my teens, and I read my diaries. I was dreaming of building a career as a musician in the United States, but that's when I was 16. I built my career in Europe and from there on around the world. And I was, since a couple of years, focusing on the States, so I definitely wanted to work here. And then that opportunity came that I could conduct the Tchaikovsky Nutcracker for the Warner Brothers production, Tom and Jerry. And it happened that they called me as a conductor and the orchestra was a Philadelphia Chamber Orchestra. And we had a great time. Musicians were thrilled. I was thrilled. So, and I got an official invitation to conduct the orchestra. And that was, I think, 2 years ago, where I conducted Das Lied von der Erde by Gustav Mahler. And that was a great experience. It was a difficult setting. It was a setting by Schoenberg, and very delicate, chamber music setting, but very, very delicate. And we had a great time together. And so then I got a second invitation to do the Scandinavian perspectives. But by that time, we were already negotiating, of course. And today, it's the first day that officially I'm very proud to announce that I'm the successor of Maestro Ignaz Solzhenitsyn, who absolutely did a marvelous, fantastic job for the orchestra. And I absolutely want to underline to keep contact with him as much as we can and invite him back as a soloist, both as a soloist and a conductor.
You mentioned Ignaz Solzhenitsyn. How would you describe his programming philosophy as you've seen it? And what do you anticipate doing differently?
Well, I see that the program is programmation is quite classical, which is the main thing of the orchestra. I mean, I will just continue to in the same programmation. I think there is a tradition, there is a client, the audience is a client, and I first want to get to know this my clients. Who are my clients? Who are the people that want to come and listen to the chamber orchestra? I want to get to know them as a person, as persons, but also as supporters of the arts, and I want to know what's going on in their head. Why they like classical music, why they hate Stockhausen, and why they like Mozart. I want to know all those
things. I think you know that already.
Yeah, I know that already. But it's interesting to talk with those people in order maybe to put some emphasis on other kinds of music. But I will not do it in the first year. So the first year will be a classical program. I'm working on that. I want to bring in very interesting soloists with fresh ideas and brilliant young players. And we will do the classical stuff, maybe going a little bit more to the Romantic period, which is absolutely my favorite period. But the music history doesn't stop with Tchaikovsky or with Brahms. I mean, great composers, but there is more than that. And I have some plans, have some ideas, but to discover that, I think people should come to the concerts. Because in every concert, maybe something could happen different from habit. And unfortunately, I cannot tell you what. I will not give it away. Otherwise, there is no surprise anymore. But what I would like to do is have a very intense communication with my clients, with the audience, and talk with them about music, about what they like, and maybe also about the music that they don't know yet. And I need some years to go through this process. And maybe it will lead to, we will stick to the classical music. That's the core business of the orchestra. But maybe we have some spin-offs, and I'm looking very much forward to this time.
Would some of those surprises include your own music?
It's a trap. I don't want to program my own music from the first day. And of course I will program my music. It's like Maestro Solzhenitsyn, he who was the music director, conductor, but also a pianist. He played quite often the piano. As I'm not an active performer anymore, it's obvious that I will want to show something from myself. And this is my music. But again, I'm not here to promote my music. I'm here to continue building the level of playing of the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia. But of course, my music will be there. But I will not force that. It should just be there in a natural way. If people are interested in hearing my music, I will program it. But I will not program 50 minutes of music in each concert of myself. That would be absolutely stupid and ridiculous.
You talked a little earlier on in the press conference about the idea of there being a Berlin sound and there being a Vienna sound. It's not really clear that there is a Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia sound. Do you want to develop a particular recognizable style for this ensemble?
First of all, you cannot compare a large symphony orchestra sound with a chamber orchestra sound, that's for sure. But I think I heard the orchestra in different configurations. First of all, the three projects I did with him. But also I was listening to the Domingo concert, I was listening to Ein Deutsches Requiem, and I felt that there still could be improvement in the way how you produce sounds. And as soon as you have two musicians that play the same melody together, then you already have several options in doing it. For example, if there is a clarinet and a flute playing unisono, do we want to hear the two instruments separately, or do we try to make maybe one new sound that creates a sound that, as it is, a new instrument that is playing? So all those options are open. I'm sure Ignat worked on that, and I definitely want to continue working on that. The string sound, for example, the most difficult thing for a string ensemble is the blending. So everybody has a personal way in producing sound, making vibration, etc., etc. But if you have 10 individuals playing the first violin part coming from 10 top orchestras in the world, it's not sure you have a nice sound. It's not sure. So it depends on the approach. I think the idea should be that the violin section, for example, you hear it as one instrument. So they really should blend, so that it has to do with the violins, the instruments, the way how they use the bow, the pressure on the bow, and also the way of making vibrato. And not everybody should do vibrato always at the same time, the same vibrato. Sometimes you can create a very special sound that some people are playing vibrato and others almost non-vibrato, that you have the mixture of those two. And these things, I think, at least we should talk about it, at least we should try it out. So I hope I will have some sessions where I can work with different groups in the orchestra only to talk about that, about sound. You see, that this is the secret of good orchestras. There used to be a time where there were orchestra builders, like Otto Klemperer, for example. He had the time to build the sound of an orchestra. Chili Bidaki, when he performed the symphony by Beethoven, sometimes he had 12 rehearsals. Not to read the notes, of course, but just to think about sound and to produce the sound. And that was the time where all those big orchestras were founded, like Amsterdam, Vienna, Berlin, Chicago Symphony, New York Philharmonic. I mean, there used to be a time that there was time to rehearse, not only to reproduce the notes, but just to build orchestras. And now, the London Symphony Orchestra, when you want to join a big orchestra like that, you have to play in that tradition. As you might take lessons with a teacher who is playing there, and when you come in that orchestra, it's not only about playing your horn or your violin, but you have to listen to the sound that is there since decades. And I think this is something that absolutely can be improved in a lot of orchestras, and also in the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia.
Final question, what to your mind are your strengths as a conductor?
Excuse me, what do you...
What to your mind, what do you think are your strengths as a conductor?
I think my strength as a conductor is technically, I think I have a very, very clear technique, that's for sure. I'm not using a baton, everything comes from the hands, and I learned that from Kurt Masur. I think I can put something together in a very short period of time, which is nowadays in the economical situation very important. I don't have 20 rehearsals to prepare a concert, so I can work very, very hard. And I think maybe my biggest skill is my mentality, my musical experience in different fields of music. I'm classical trained. I started as a double bass player and a trumpet player. I started playing in orchestras for many years. I was once first trumpet player in the opera orchestra. So I know how all those things are functioning. I know the psychology about musicians, etc., etc. But I think my strongest thing is that I can take all the good things from all the bad things I did in my life. I mean, not that I did bad things as such, but all those experiences. I did commercial music. I did classical music. I worked with purists. I prepared concerts for other conductors. I did a lot of classical music, a lot of Mozart, Beethoven, Haydn even, in a traditional way of playing, so with the articulation and the bowing, etc., etc. But I also did commercial work. I also did pop concerts. I did music by Pink Floyd, where you need completely different skills. So I think a musician today, performer today, a soloist today, but also a conductor, should be somebody with a very broad view on the music. And I think this is maybe my most interesting skill that I can bring to the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia.
The Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia's new music director, Dirk Brosse.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
The Rosenbach Museum and Library in Center City, Philadelphia, is a repository for original documents and artifacts. James Joyce's manuscript for Ulysses, Bram Stoker's Notes for Dracula, original illustrations for Lewis Carroll's Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, to name but a few. Yet there are also objects that, due to accident, innocence, or even deliberate deceit, are not quite what they seem. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis explores an exhibition that considers how and why items are copied or altered over time, and why it matters or doesn't.
It's often been sort of a dirty little secret that museums contain all kinds of things that aren't perfect.
Judy Gustin, curator and director of collections at the Rosenbach Museum and Library, says people are conditioned to think that things must be perfect and pristine to have value.
And we wanted to sort of dispel that myth in a way. There are all kinds of things in collections that have these other stories to them.
The other stories of how and why documents, objects, and paintings have been copied or altered is the subject of the show Friend or Foe, F-A-U-X, Imitation and Invention from Innocent to the Fraudulent. It explores legitimate copies and forgeries, issues of authentication and attribution, and why local legends spring up about things that never were. There's a portrait by 19th century artist Thomas Scully and a copy made by someone else.
The person in the original was already dead. The son of the sitter was visiting Philadelphia, wanted a copy of this portrait of his father because he was moving far away. He was moving to Kentucky. And the father's painter was not available.
So the artist's daughter, who had honed her skills copying her father's work, painted another copy of the portrait.
And so the question is, if these two paintings were apart, could you tell the difference between them? And would that matter?
In some cases, an object or document was altered to make something whole. An original edition of The Pilgrim's Progress turns out to be patched together from several separate books. Rosenbach librarian Elizabeth Fuller says the popular book had been just about read to pieces, literally, because complete first editions were then impossible to find. People like the museum's co-founder, a rare book collector, would just create one.
In 1921, Dr. Rosenbach bought three copies, each of which was missing a number of pages. The copy we have here, every page is a page from a first edition of Pilgrim's Progress, just not all from the same copy to begin with.
Standards of acceptable restoration were different then. Curatorial assistant Kathy Haas points to two portrait miniatures which were spruced up by repainting.
Nowadays, if you take something to a conservator, they tend to be very minimalist about what kinds of additions and changes they will make in an attempt to conserve the work. And in fact, a conservator who looked at one of these two miniatures actually noted that it would be very easy to confuse this miniature of the Bishop of Winchester with a forgery because so little of the original paint surface is at all visible or survives.
Then there are also copies actually created to deceive. Dr. Rosenbach was a fan of Shakespeare and Shakespeare forgeries, like those by a young, late 18th century Englishman. This real-life tale of ambition and deceit is read to visitors by Jack Lynch, Associate Professor of English at Rutgers University.
William Henry Ireland began discovering Shakespeare manuscripts in 1794 while he was still a teenager, and at first the critical world believed they were genuine.
The story is that after Ireland found an undiscovered Shakespearean play and tried to stage it, he was eventually found out. But it also made him something of a celebrity.
And he knew his original handwritten forgeries would be worth money as mementos of the famous dispute of the 1790s. So he pasted the original Shakespeare manuscripts into albums like this one, added prefaces and captions explaining when and how he forged them, and sold the lot to a book collector.
Ireland's forgeries themselves did become valuable enough to copy.
William Henry Ireland was selling forged Shakespeare and then even forgeries of his own forgeries.
In some other purchases, Dr. Rosenbach was fooled. Curatorial assistant Kathy Haas says he enjoyed a silver mug with the monogram GW on the front. On the bottom is a birthday inscription to George Washington.
He bought it from a British dealer, W.E. Hercombe, for £15 in 1925. He believed it to be genuine.
But it turned out to be a fake. Another con? Elizabeth Fuller shows us the first page of a manuscript which purports to be The Fall of the House of Usher by Edgar Allan Poe.
It appears to be in Poe's handwriting, even appears to have notes by Poe's editor with the editor's initials. Unfortunately, although Dr. Rosenbach bought it as a genuine Poe manuscript, it's not. It's a forgery.
A forgery, however, by a famous forger, Edgar Cosey, who, like William Henry Ireland a century before, acquired his own form of celebrity.
And fooled a number of people to the extent that his forgeries are now collectible in themselves. They're so collectible that some collectors are now worried about the possibility of fake Coseys.
Today, technology has enabled more thorough checks of the origins of works where there are questions, from scientific analysis to internet communication with other museums and scholars all over the world. But regardless of historical facts, most objects have stories attached, and some local legends just won't go away. This show includes Nathaniel Hawthorne's personal copy of Moby Dick, but it's not inscribed by Herman Melville, as many believe. There's also a manuscript copy of one of the most famous legal documents in America.
The Declaration of Independence.
But not in the hand of you-know-who.
It was written in the 18th century, but ours was not written by Thomas Jefferson. Nonetheless, we always get a lot of inquiries about what about that Thomas Jefferson copy of the Declaration of Independence.
So what does drive our fascination with objects? Whose company they've kept? Whose hand made those smudges? Whose lips brushed that mug? The Rosenbach sometimes brings objects out of their cases on special house tours.
When someone finally realizes that they are touching something that one of our founding fathers wrote, it's thrilling. Those objects can really stir your emotions.
In a world where most of us live surrounded by copies of some sort, even if they're not scandalous forgeries or altered heirlooms, it's worth considering what we value, whether we're collectors or just museum visitors. Old objects, original documents, or copies of a holiday photograph. Maybe just something that connects us with someone we knew or wish we had.
WRTI Susan Lewis. Friend or Foe, Imitation and Invention, From Innocent to the Fraudulent, is at the Rosenbach Museum and Library in Philadelphia through July 11th. Here's one apple that fell light years from the tree. Composer Julia Wolf is one of downtown Manhattan's most radical minimalists, getting even more music out of a sliver of ideas and with more decibels than the likes of Philip Glass or Steve Reich. That's not what usually comes out of small town Montgomeryville, where Wolf grew up, or even from 1970s South Street, where Wolf hung out when it was Philadelphia's counterculture nerve center. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns followed Wolf around New York recently as she celebrated the release of her new CD and prepared for the biggest concert of her life, tonight at Carnegie Hall.
Ambient music, only aggressive. That was the only way that you could describe the sensation of 9 bagpipes, 8 of them on tape, playing simultaneously at a Soho art gallery at 11 o'clock on a gray Tuesday morning. The occasion was a celebration of Julia Wolf's new CD, Full Dark Ride, featuring a series of pieces for amassed instruments in an exhaustive exploration of sound that the fun, articulate 50-year-old composer describes as her journey to the center of the earth, or, when with bagpipes, ambience that becomes even more aggressive.
I like that. It's funny because we're always looking for terms like aggressive ambient. I love the instrument. I mean, the instrument itself is like an orchestra. It's so reedy and so many overtones, so complex. I tend towards relentless and dense. So I like that.
Her pieces don't conclude as much as they end when they just can't go on anymore, like when her journey in sound hits the molten core. It's hard to envision what that might sound like with 9 bagpipes, but not for her or her virtuoso bagpiper, Matthew Welch.
The sound at the very end is sort of like this Jimi Hendrix-type distorted guitar sound, and he's just going, la, la, la. He's like moving his hands over, I don't know what he's doing exactly, but it's his sound. And I just found these things by hanging out with them and putting earplugs in. And
maybe it's more like apocalyptic ambient music. After the performance, I saw some construction workers with Irish accents who were outside eavesdropping. One of them said, not bad. Another said, still learning. On that last part, Wolf would probably agree. She's always looking for new sounds. She still casts her net wide. Her piece, My Lips From Speaking, is based on a brief, pithy riff from the Aretha Franklin song, Think. Refracted with the idea that 6 pianos are more emphatic than 1. Wolf's latest fascination is with music that moves, physically. She recently had a commission from the architecture festival, Evento, in Bordeaux, for a piece that came to be titled Travel Music. Some 100 musicians moved throughout the city's old winding streets in bicycle cabs, beginning at a square at the Opera House, some in red shirts, some in green shirts, some playing instruments, others listening to pre-composed sounds on MP3 players and vocally imitating what they heard. Don't expect the Philadelphia Orchestra to perform this one anytime soon.
I don't know if I necessarily, want to take an orchestra and put them in the streets, but there was something really beautiful and interesting about the sound moving. When sound is coming towards you, and if you could do something like that, I don't know how you could do it with an orchestra. You'd have to have some very special kind of space, but if the sound approaching with that kind of massive body of players, off the top of my head, that sounds like an interesting thing to think about. It would definitely be an ideal world, because I don't think they move off their chairs too often.
Wolf left Philadelphia for the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor at age 18 or so. Dance, theater, playwriting, botany, sociology. She could have done any one of them. She was also trained as a pianist and played various folk instruments. The idea of being a composer, however, didn't really hit her until she took a hands-on music class in which composing of some sort, maybe any sort, was required. It changed her life. Why was composing so much more appealing? In a crowded New York coffee shop, she explained.
It's crazier. You can be really normal and be a folk musician, but music just spoke to me. I went to college thinking I was probably going to do something like sociology or something, psychology. But I felt like everything I was doing, I was talking about other people doing things. And then I did music, and I thought, I'm doing something.
During this period, she also met her husband, composer Michael Gordon. They had 2 children and eventually formed the composer collective known as Bang on a Can, which has become the brand name in New York for experimental music, even if co-founder David Lang has been so embraced by the establishment that he recently won the Pulitzer Prize. Wolf went to Yale and Princeton, plus having a Fulbright year in Holland, where she became friends with the Dutch minimalist Louis Andriessen. Like her, he's from a small town. She asked him, how did he come to be where he is? They both chalked it up to the curiosity gene. Wolf's life now has almost nothing but such curious people, even if her children run for cover when she's working with bagpipes. First and foremost among her colleagues is her husband. Though in past eras both Schumann and Mahler didn't always take well to their wives' composing, Michael Gordon loves it. He needs not go very far for musical advice, he explained at his wife's album release party, and with their 25-year history together, it's advice he won't take from very many other places.
At a certain point, you know, you can't have a candid conversation with someone about your music, you know, except for someone you've been able to have that conversation with for a very long time, you know.
So nobody bats an eye when Julia Wolf comes up with the idea to compose for 8 acoustic double basses in a piece titled Stronghold. The surprise is that in live performance, the sound takes on a shimmer that I assumed came from some sort of electronic manipulation. When I was talking to her afterwards out on the street, she set me straight.
How important was the electronic element?
There is no electronic element.
Oh.
It's the room. And also because of it's the room, and I think it's the 8 basses. It's a really weird acoustical phenomenon when they get together. The overtones of 8 basses, because they're so low and so deep.
Wolf's newest piece, Steel Hammer, is her most ambitious yet. The Carnegie Hall Commission inspired her to have a different kind of scope. It's a full evening piece, unusual for a normally terse composer. Instead of going narrow and deep, she's expanding, back to her years as a denizen in Ann Arbor coffee houses and the instruments that she used to play there.
I can definitely feel the return to some of those roots. One of the melodies I wrote the other day, someone said, hey, it's kind of a different turn for you. And I said, yeah, you know, it's closer to what I might have done 20 years ago. And so it's just, I mean, it's different because I've been, you know, it's a big evolution that's happened to me over that time period, but it's going back to some of that sensibility.
An elaborate production is planned for this evening. There will be a set with crude handmade lanterns in an attempt to give a sitting around the campfire effect. There's a vocal element, sung by the acclaimed Scandinavian group, Trio Medieval. After Steel Hammer, Julia Wolf may no longer be a downtown composer, figuratively or philosophically. Not that she'll become tame. During a recent album promotion performance in an uptown venue, the audience was asked to silence their cell phones, but if he didn't, she probably wouldn't be able to hear them anyway.
Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. Julia Wolf's new CD is out now on the Cantaloupe label. And that's it for now. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ribchester, and performed by Symphony in C under Rossin Milnoff. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.